Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. The tax debate has become very confused. After the government appearing to favour an increase in the GST to finance substantial income tax cuts, Malcolm Turnbull has now walked away from the GST option. He says the economic benefits from such a change would not be big enough to justify the trouble. Two premiers have been promoting the case for big tax reform over the last few months: New South Wales Liberal Premier Mike Baird and South Australian Labor Premier Jay Weatherill. Jay Weatherill incurred his federal Labor colleagues' wrath when he was willing to countenance a higher GST as part of changes that would deliver substantial revenue for the state for hospitals and schools. Now that Turnbull has decided to make himself a smaller target, the South Australian Premier and his New South Wales colleague have been left out on limbs. Jay Weatherill joins us today to talk about tax. Premier, thank you for being with us.
Pleasure.
Do you now regret that you ever went out to countenance a possible rise in the GST?
No, absolutely not. Just the only way you can constructively approach big public policy issues is to not just front up with a problem, you also need to front up with a solution. That's the approach I take to all of these issues, whatever they are, and I certainly have no regrets about that.
You're willing to put your head on the block, though, within the Labor Party. This issue is quite a totemic one for many in the ALP. Did you feel a bit lonely out there? People weren't coming to your defence?
No, look, what also is totemic is the massive Labor project of public education and public health. And I don't think there's a wide enough appreciation yet of the threats to both of those systems. And we have a public education system that's not meeting the needs of the bottom 20% of our children in the system that have special needs. And we have a public healthcare system which will grind to a halt, and we'll have an American-style system if we don't have the level of funding support necessary to maintain it. And this is what we're looking at. These two Labor projects, the introduction of Medibank by Gough Whitlam, the reforms that we've made to create universal free public education. I mean, these are the great projects which deal with inequality in our community. They're also at the heart of our economic prosperity. They're under threat. And I'm duty-bound when I see that threat clearly to raise it and also to seek solutions.
Your condition always was that a big change in the tax system had to be conditional on money going to the states for health and education.
Yeah.
And yet all through, it seemed to me, Scott Morrison was saying no go to that. He was saying, no, we're not going to countenance any extra spending from such a change. Did you feel that that was a negotiating position, that in the end he would have to give way on that?
Yes, and that's why we made our intervention, because you're right, there was a stalemate in the debate. There were basically the two sides of the argument. My side of the argument was saying extra revenue should go to health and education. His side of the argument, that is, extra revenue should be used to switch from direct to indirect taxation, so from company tax, income tax, to a broad-based consumption tax. And so, because it's obvious you can't spend the same dollar of revenue twice, what needed to happen was there needed to be a circuit breaker. So that's where I proposed that the Commonwealth was so concerned to ensure that tax reform should involve a tax mix switch, which seemed to be what Scott Morrison was implying, then I proposed that they should accept and argue for an increase in the GST from 10 to 15%, keep the proceeds and apply it to that reform agenda, whereas the states would then have the current specific purpose payments converted into a share of income tax, which we estimated to be in the order of 17.5%. And that would give us a source of revenue which grew at a rate which more approximates the rate of growth of healthcare, and therefore deals with the health and education funding gaps. So that's the equation that I put, and It was an attempt to, in a sense, be a circuit breaker to this obvious stalemate.
Do you think that the issue of states getting a share of income tax is still on the table, even though the GST seems to be off the table?
Well, it can be. There's no doubt about it. I mean, my proposition remains, I think, a good idea with or without the GST. What I was seeking to do was to create room for both sides in the argument. I mean, I'm serious about getting a result here, not just about posturing about cuts to health and education. I mean, I can do that, but, and, you know, we'll have plus or minus some political benefit out of embarrassing the Commonwealth for its $80 billion cut to health and education. What I'm more interested in, though, is a solution. And I can see the Commonwealth have a revenue problem. There's a $37.4 billion deficit on the federal budget, and that's after they've saved $80 billion in health and education funding over the next 10 years. So there's an obvious revenue problem, so that's why we sought to create some room for them. But in a sense, we've got different imperatives here, the states and the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth have a short-term massive funding problem. The states, though, on the other side, have a much more substantial long-term problem. It ramps up very considerably over the next few years, but it comes unbearable by about the 10 or 15-year mark. And so that's why, in a sense, the GST is not the solution to the state's problems, because, in a sense, it raises too much money in the early years and too little in the later years, because GST is not growing at the rate of the growth of our healthcare expenditure. So even if we were to get a 15% GST, it would just kick the can down the road for another 10 or 15 years and we'd be back talking about this problem. So that's why I suggested we shift to a share of income tax, which provides much more durable and sustainable solutions to the state's long-term health and education funding needs. But you're right, it does stand alone. It doesn't need a 15% GST to support it.
I must say the whole tax debate, where it is at the moment very confusing. The states have now cancelled a meeting they were going to have to discuss options, and we really don't know where the Commonwealth is. Are you getting any sort of feedback? What's your readout of the whole thing?
Well, my readout of the whole thing is that the reason the debate's confusing is this hasn't started with the proper definition of the problem. I mean, it's always going to be confusing if you keep coming up with answers to questions that nobody knows have been asked. That's why I saw very clearly to define the problem as a revenue problem. And I think it's blindingly obvious that if you're running a $37.4 billion deficit after you've saved $80 billion in health and education cuts, you've got yourself a revenue problem. Now, nobody likes to hear the problem defined in that way, because it implies that somebody's got to pay some more taxation. But you only need to look. I mean, the glib one-liners we get in response is, I'll be more efficient in your hospital system. Well, if you look across all of the OECD nations, we're at the bottom of the list in terms of health expenditures as a proportion of our economy. We already have an efficient healthcare system. Can it be more efficient? Yes. Are those efficiencies going to do anything to meet the massive hole that we have in our health funding? No. And that's why we need to have this debate. And the same with education. We had a thorough review undertaken by businessman David Gonski in relation to the education funding. He found we have a very unequal system in this country, one of the most unequal of advanced countries, where the bottom 20% of students aren't getting their special needs met. And that requires additional resources. The glib one-liner that it's all about teacher quality doesn't cut it. And we're already seeing the benefits of the early Gonski money in turning around circumstances for children with special needs. So, you know, so we need problem definition. The problem is a lack of revenue, and we need to find an equitable way of funding the gap between what we need as a nation and what we're collecting at the moment.
The Commonwealth says to you, be more efficient, but it says something else too, and that is raise more tax yourself. Malcolm Turnbull made the point the other day that the states have, in fact, some efficient tax bases. What's your response to him there?
Well, we undertook a thorough taxation review prior to even embarking on this debate. We could see that this debate was emerging, and so we wanted to get our own house in order first. So we undertook a taxation review last year. It ran for about 4 months. We landed it in our state budget. And we essentially got rid of every business transaction tax. We cashed them in, and we did put the burden back on land-based taxes and the very taxes that Malcolm Turnbull thinks that are efficient. But after having done that, we actually have some of the larger land-based taxes in the Federation. We're advised that's the most efficient way to raise taxes. But if he's now asking us to increase them any further, it will put us in a very disadvantageous position in relation to the Federation. We will have land taxes that will be way out of whack with other places. And I think it's an invitation to do something which I think is a bit glib. We were in a partnership to work through these issues, and now we're being told, well, the Commonwealth, after having put an $80 billion cut in, is walking away and saying, well, it's your problem, you fix it yourself. And I don't think that's consistent with the spirit of the Federation, nor I think is it just, given that they're the authors of much of our difficulty.
Did you expect Malcolm Turnbull to be easier to work with?
I did, actually. I thought this sort of approach we're now getting from Malcolm Turnbull is the sort of thing that reminds us of dealing with Tony Abbott. You know, the glib one-liners, what I have described as an infantile debate where you can just focus on one thing without looking at the whole picture. I mean, how can you possibly talk about one tax measure without talking about what we need our taxation system for, which is to raise the revenues to meet the basic service needs of our community? I mean, there's always a cheap point to be made in a tax debate. The mature approach is to discuss the needs and be honest with people about what those needs look like, and then discuss the range of options and how we might meet those needs. And I think what we're getting actually now is dithering. We have a Prime Minister that clearly doesn't know what the next step is. If he'd stuck with the states and stayed faithful to the process that was outlined to us, that is, there would be a discussion paper, a green paper, and then a white paper, we'd have much greater clarity. And I think having to express yourself in writing about all these imperatives would have given a greater clarity to the debate. But now we're in a hyper-political environment in the lead-up to an election, and I do fear where this is going to lead.
How have you found Scott Morrison to deal with compared with Joe Hockey?
Oh, look, I mean, they're all thoroughly charming to talk to, but, that's not really the point. It's about getting a result, and I'm just seeing no clarity. I mean, people keep saying, you know, our contribute, being patted on the head and saying thank you for your constructive contribution, but we're just not seeing any concrete response, and you know, that's what we want to see. We want to see an honest definition of the problem and some realistic discussion of the solution. I think, you know, the Australian people are intelligent enough to understand that there's more money going out than there is coming in, and they just want a bit of honest conversation about that rather than... I think they're also... want to have people level with them about what they can expect in terms of health and education services rather than just clip one-liners about us getting our house in order and making some efficiencies.
You've worked closely across the political divide with Mike Baird. He must be pretty disappointed at the latest turn of events also. Have you spoken to him?
I have, but look, I'll let Mike speak for himself. When Mike first came out and proposed 15% GST increase to be applied to health and education funding, I supported the public discussion of that, which was a controversial thing to do, because I thought it was significant that a Conservative leader in this country would stand up and say that we weren't collecting enough revenue to meet, you know, the needs of the nation. And I wanted him supported in that. I could have hidden behind the usual rhetoric, that is that, you know, the GST is a no-go zone for us. and that, and then just kept banging on about cuts. But he came, I think, with a mature proposition, which was a problem and a solution. And I wanted to support that style of thinking in. Whether it's, I fully accept that there are more than one way to deal with this issue. It may not be that the GST is the best approach, but it's going to be that style of thinking that's going to lead us to the result that we need to get. And it's worth mentioning, though, that Mike Baird's proposition about GST is to compensate under $100,000 earnings in a household, so that if you were earning less than $100,000 in your household, you wouldn't pay any additional increase in the GST. You'd be compensated through the tax or the benefit transfer system. So in South Australia, that's 66% of households.
Now, on your own side of politics, you've shrugged off the attacks on you, which were quite fierce at times. But do you think in general Labor needs to be more open-minded, federal and state Labor, about changes to the tax system, that really this anti-GST increase argument's now a bit outdated, more around 2000 than 2016?
Well, the first thing is, I mean, I obviously welcome the response of Federal Labor on the education funding. They've committed to reinstate years 5 and 6 that have been cut by the federal Liberal government in terms of funding, and they have a plan to fund that gap. So I think that's a good thing. That's a positive thing. What we need to see from Federal Labor, though, is a response to the healthcare funding challenge. Look, I think there are obviously different elements within the Labor Party. I represent a particular element. South Australia's always been much more progressive, open-minded in the discussion of ideas. There are different cultures around the party, and obviously you saw that on display. But look, I think the future for us is to engage. I think there's a massive political opportunity for Labor at the moment to step into this gap created by Malcolm Turnbull. I mean, he's dithering. The federal Liberal government is, I think, a bit clueless at the moment in the tax reform agenda, and there's a big opportunity for Federal Labor.
It is going to have to produce, though, a big health policy to meet a problem the size that you're depicting.
Sure.
So how can it find the money for that? And have you any suggestions as to the direction in which that policy should go?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's a big challenge. I mean, once you take the GST off the table, it is a big challenge. But as I said, the challenge for the states and territories is in the longer term. I mean, our proposition about a share of income tax, we think, is a valuable contribution. In the short term, obviously, the states are also facing a ramping up of the cuts, which are still very big in even the next few years. One proposition is to broaden the base of the GST to cover financial services, which I understand has much broader support than increasing the GST to 15%. Taxing financial services has been recommended by a number of inquiries, including the Henry Review and other reviews. It raises, on our estimates, between $3 and $4 billion per annum. That would make an important short-term contribution to meeting the health and education funding gap, but that's a proposition we've been advancing for some time now.
And have you been pressing that on your Labor colleagues, your federal colleagues?
Well, now, of course, the debate's taken this turn. Yes, we will be advancing that more strongly. It has the advantage of being a more progressive tax, tending to have a higher burden on higher income earners because of the nature of financial transactions. But it does give us, I think, a potential way forward. I mean, whether we can solve the whole 15-year funding challenge or whether we can get a solution for the next 5 years, these are all things that will now be exercising the minds of people that are working in this area, I think.
Would you like to see them embrace your idea of giving the states a slice of income tax?
Absolutely. I think that's got benefits for a range of reasons. The way it works is that some of the specific purpose payments that are negotiated between the Commonwealth and the states have lots of strings attached to them. So the Commonwealth doles out money, but they also have a range of bureaucratic rules about how you get access to it. you add all those specific purpose payments up, including the health, the education, the housing and welfare sectors, and convert them into a dollar number and then convert that into a percentage of income tax, it gives you, on our estimates, around about 17.5%. The advantage of that is that income tax does grow at a much greater rate than GST, and that gives you a much greater chance of meeting the growth in healthcare. But the other opportunity it gives you is that it gives states much more autonomy to take steps within their own states to innovate without the bureaucratic strings attached that occur under the current system. It saves a lot of bureaucracy at both ends.
Have you talked to Chris Bowen on this, and is he at all attracted?
Oh, look, every proposition that I've put to the Commonwealth Government, I've shared first before I've made them public with each of my state and territory colleagues, and also with Federal Labor, of course, with the Federal Government. So they're fully aware of my ideas, but obviously we'll see whether they're being entertained. I know there's at least some interest in Federal Treasury in relation to some of these ideas.
Just on the question of South Australia and the local scene there, the Federal Liberals were travelling very badly in your state when Tony Abbott was Prime Minister.
Yeah.
Do you think South Australia now will be more of a struggle for Labor than it had looked some months,
a
year ago?
The equation has changed a little since Malcolm Turnbull has become Prime Minister, but not as much as I think the local Liberals would have hoped. I think there are real doubts about whether Malcolm Turnbull is perhaps what he's cracked up to be. I mean, where to see any results here in South Australia. A big issue for us is 12 new submarines being committed to be built here in South Australia. That was a promise. Tony Abbott appeared to be walking away from it, and we're certainly hopeful to restore that. But there are remaining issues. There's the lingering distaste about the decision by the federal government to close down the car industry, and I think really the inadequate response to deal with the aftermath. So, you know, obviously federal levels here are scrambling to catch to make up for what is a great deal of scepticism about their commitment to South Australia. I mean, South Australia is being disproportionately affected by the transformation in the Australian economy. We had the largest proportion of our economy devoted to manufacturing, which was smashed by the high dollar for a couple of years. We're beginning to recover now, but we still have to consume the closure of Holden. And I think people understand that in South Australia we need a much more assertive response to the Commonwealth Government. And we have a significant list of projects and partnerships that we're putting before the Commonwealth to assist us to meet that challenge.
And just finally, how do you think the new Nick Xenophon team will go at the election, especially in your state and his state of South Australia?
Well, look, I mean, Nick's an opportunist. I mean, you know, generally speaking, he's a positive force for South Australia because he raises issues for us. But, you know, he seeks to outflank people on the left and the right when the bigger political mood takes his fancy. So
gets a lot of votes.
Well, sure, but in the end of the day, you have to govern and you have to make hard choices. And, you know, Nick has never had to accept that responsibility. So, look, we do partner with Nick in important issues. He was a good ally in Holden's. He's been a good ally in future submarines. You know, we seek to work with him. And, look, there's only one thing I'm interested in, standing up for South Australia. If Nick can work with me to achieve that, obviously that's a beneficial partnership.
Jay Weatherall, thank you very much for talking with us today, and that's all from our Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins, and we'll be back with another interview soon.